Chapter 6. As far as creature comforts were concerned, Jack Aubrey was far, far better off than anyone else in the Worcester. He had privacy, he had space, as well as the great cabin in which he took his ease or entertained or played his fiddle, and the stern gallery in which he took the air when he chose to take it alone rather than on the thickly populated quarterdeck. He had a dining cabin and a sleeping cabin, the fore cabin where he taught his youngsters and attended to his paperwork, and quarter galleries as lavatory and place of ease. He had his own steward and his own cook, a great deal of room for his private livestock, provisions and wine, and enough in the way of pay and allowances for a provident single man to lay in an adequate supply. It was ungrateful in him to be discontented, as he admitted in the long rambling letter that he wrote day by day to Sophie, a letter, or rather an instalment of the letter in which he described Stephen's departure. Ungrateful and illogical. He had always known that the Navy was given to extremes, and most of the extremes he had experienced himself, beginning with that truly startling lack of space that had faced him early in his career, when an angry captain disrated him, so that from one day to the next he was no longer a midshipman, but a foremast hand, a common sailor required to sling his hammock on the Resolution's lower deck at the regulation 14 inches from his neighbours. Since the Resolution was a two-watch ship, with half her people on deck when the other half were below, in practice these 14 inches increased to 28. But even so, Jack's bulky neighbours touched him on either side as they all rolled together on the swell, part of a carpet of humanity, some hundreds strong, unventilated, unwashed, apart from hands and faces, given to snoring, grinding their teeth, calling out in their short, troubled sleep, never more than 4 hours at a time, and rarely so much. Disrating was a rough experience, and it had seemed to last forever. But it was of great value, teaching him more about the men and about their attitude towards officers, work, and one another, than he could ever have learnt on the quarterdeck, teaching him a very great many things, among them the value of space. Yet here he was, with space to be measured by the rod, pole, or perch, rather than by the square inches of the midshipman's berth, or the square foot of his days as a lieutenant. Space, and even headroom too, a point of real importance to a man of his height, and a rare privilege in ships designed for people of 5'6". He had space and to spare, and he did not appreciate it as he should have done. One of the troubles was that it was uninhabited space, since by another of the Navy's rules of extremes he now ate and lived quite alone, whereas on the lower deck he had dined in the company of 500 hearty eaters, and even in his various gunroom and wardroom messes with a dozen or so, never a meal alone until he reached command. But from that time on, never a meal accompanied, except by express invitation. He did, of course, invite his officers quite often, and although in the present anxious, unsettled state of his affairs he dared not keep the lavish table of earlier, richer days, it was rare that Pullings and a midshipman did not breakfast with him, while the officer of the forenoon watch and a youngster or a marine would often share his dinner, and the wardroom entertained him once a week. Breakfast and dinner, then, were reasonably companionable, but Jack dined at 3. And since he was not a man who turned in early, that left a great deal of time, far more than the concerns of a ship on blockade could fill, a ship with a thoroughly efficient first lieutenant, plying to and fro off Toulon, all decisions taken by the flag. The familiar tedium of blockade made these spacious, lonely evenings lonelier and more spacious by far, but in one form or another they were the lot common to all captains who respected tradition and who wished to maintain their authority. Some dealt with the situation by having their wives aboard, in spite of the regulations, particularly on the longer, quieter passages, and some took mistresses, but neither would do in a squadron commanded by Admiral Thornton. Others sailed with friends, and although Jack had known this answer fairly well, generally speaking it seemed that few friendships could stand such close, enforced proximity for many weeks, let alone months, or even years. There were also men who took to drinking too much, while some grew strange, crotchety, and absolute. and although the great majority became neither confirmed drunkards nor eccentrics, nearly all captains with more than a few years' service were deeply marked by it. So far, Jack had been unusually lucky in this respect. From his first command, he had nearly always sailed with Stephen Maturin, and it had proved the happiest arrangement. As her surgeon, Dr. Maturin was very much part of the ship, having his own independent function and being, one no more than nominally subject to the captain. But since he was not an executive officer, their intimacy caused no jealousy or ill feeling in the wardroom, and although he and Jack Aubrey were almost as unlike as men could be, unlike in nationality, religion, education, size, shape, profession, habit of mind, they were united in a deep love of music, and many an evening they had played together, violin answering cello, or both singing together far into the night. Now, when the fiddle sang at all, it sang alone. But since Stephen's departure he had rarely been in a mood for music, and in any case the partita that he was now engaged upon, one of the manuscript works that he had bought in London, grew more and more strange the deeper he went into it. The opening movements were full of technical difficulties, and he doubted he would ever be able to do them anything like justice, but it was the great chaconne which followed that really disturbed him. On the face of it, the statements made in the beginning were clear enough. Their closely argued variations, though complex, could certainly be followed with full acceptation, and they were not particularly hard to play. Yet at one point, after a curiously insistent repetition of the second theme, the rhythm changed, and with it the whole logic of the discourse. There was something dangerous about what followed, something not unlike the edge of madness, or at least of a nightmare. And although Jack recognised that the whole sonata, and particularly the chaconne, was a most impressive composition, he felt that if he were to go on playing it with all his heart, it might lead him to very strange regions indeed. During a pause in his evening letter, Jack thought of telling Sophie of a notion that had come to him, a figure that might make the nature of the chaconne more understandable. It was as though he were fox-hunting, mounted on a powerful, spirited horse, and as though on leaping a bank, perfectly in hand, the animal changed foot. And with the change of foot came a change in its being, so that it was no longer a horse he was sitting on, but a great rough beast, far more powerful, that was swarming along at great speed over an unknown countryside in pursuit of a quarry. What quarry he could not tell, but it was no longer the simple fox. But it would be a difficult notion to express, he decided, and in any case Sophie did not really care much for music, while she positively disliked horses. On the other hand, she dearly loved a play, so he told her about the Worcester's performance.
"Neither the oratorio nor Hamlet has come off yet, and I think that for beginners we aimed a little high, since both call for a world of preparation. I have no doubt we shall hear them in the end, but in the meantime we content ourselves with much less ambitious entertainments. We have them once a week, weather permitting, on the evenings of Make and Mend Day. A surprisingly good band of 10 performers, some dancers good enough for Sadler's Wells, short dramatic pieces, and a kind of farce that carries on from one week to the next, very popular, in which two old forecastle hands show a fat, stupid landsman the duties of a sailor and the customs of the navy, banging him with bladders every time he does wrong." He smiled again, remembering the massive laughter of 500 close-packed men as the fool, beaten on both sides, fell into the bucket for the 7th time. Then, as he brought his paragraph to a close, his mind drifted back to his sonata. It was not music that he would have chosen to play when he was alone and low in his spirits, but he was not allowed to change or give up once he had fairly started on a piece, so when he played at all it was this partita that he worked upon, playing in a non-committal way and attending chiefly to the technical aspect of the thing.
"At least I shall be word perfect when Stephen comes back," he said, "and I shall ask his opinion of it."
Upon the whole, Jack Aubrey was not much given to lowness of spirits, and circumstances far more adverse than these had not disturbed his cheerful mind. But now a slowly maturing cold, the monotony of the blockade, the unvarying sight of the Pompeii ahead and the Boyne astern on the starboard tack, and the other way about on the larboard, a long and most unseasonable, un-Mediterranean spell of dismal weather, combined with his loneliness and isolation to bring him down. He let his mind run over his complicated affairs at home, a very useless exercise, since the legal issues were obscure to experts, let alone to sailors, whose law was contained in the 36 Articles of War, and over his position here. On taking command of the Worcester, he had known that she was bound for the Mediterranean, and that Hart was second in command to Admiral Thornton on that station. But the Admiral Thornton he and all his friends had always known had so very strong and dominant a personality that his second would count for very little, particularly when he was so small a man as Hart. Had Jack known how likely it was that Hart might inherit the supreme command, he would have pressed hard for another ship. These reflections were running through his mind as he leant on the stern gallery rail a few days later, holding a handkerchief to his streaming nose, looking sometimes at the Worcester's grey and turbid wake, sometimes at the Pompey's bows a cable's length astern, and sometimes at the Dryad, Babington's slab-sided tub stationed well out to the leeward to repeat signals up and down the line. A diminished line, since the Admiral had run down to Palermo for a few days, and the inshore squadron had been reinforced. But even so it covered a mile of sea as the squadron stood eastwards through the gloom, and the task of repeating was no sinecure, particularly as they were hauled close to the wind, a wretched angle for a signal lieutenant, and as Hart was perpetually fiddling with his flags. By this time Jack was perfectly well acquainted with the numbers of all the ships in the squadron, and although from his place in taut-drawn line he could see little beyond the Pompeii and odd glimpses of the Achilles directly in her wake, he caught all Hart's loquacity echoed from the Dryad, and he saw the Culloden required to make more sail, the Boreas told to keep her station, and a distant frigate, the Clio, repeatedly ordered to alter course. And as he watched, nursing his red nose in a red-spotted handkerchief, he saw a number that he did not recognize, together with a hoist requiring the ship in question to take a position astern of the Thetis. Some newcomer had joined the fleet. For a moment he had a wild hope that she might have come out from home, bringing letters and news, but then he realized that in such a case Pullings would certainly have sent to tell him. Still he felt a curiosity about the stranger, and he turned to go on deck. At the same moment Killick came out of the cabin with a bucket full of handkerchiefs to dry on his private line.
"Now, sir, what's all this?" he cried angrily. "No great coat, no cloak, no bleeding comforter even?"
Ordinarily Captain Aubrey could quell his steward with a firm glance, but now Killick's moral superiority was so great that Jack only muttered something about
"putting his nose out for a moment, no more,"
and walked into the cabin with its unnecessary hanging stove heated cherry red.
"Who has come into the fleet?" he asked.
"What the doctor would say, was he here? I do not know," said Killick. "He would carry on something cruel about folk risking the pulmonary. He would say you ought to be in your cot."
"Give me a glass of hot lemon shrub, will you, Killick?" said Jack. "Who is come into the fleet? Bear a hand."
"I got to hang the wipes out first, ain't I?" said Killick. "Only Niobe from off of Alex. Spoke to the Admiral off of Sicily. Sent on here."
Jack was sipping his hot lemon shrub and reflecting upon moral superiority, its enormous strength in all human relationships, but even more so between husband and wife, the contest for it in even quite loving couples, the acknowledgement of defeat in even the least candid, when he heard a boat hailed from the quarter-deck. The answer, "Aye, aye," made it clear that an officer was coming aboard, and it occurred to Jack that it might be Mr. Pitt, the Niobe's surgeon, a great friend of Stephen's, perhaps coming over to see him, not knowing he was gone. A man he would be happy to see. But as he passed through the door to the quarter-deck, he gathered from Pulling's expression that it was not Mr. Pitt, nor anything agreeable at all.
"It is Davis again, sir," said Pullings.
"That's right, sir,"
cried a huge dark seaman in a hairy coat.
"Old Davis again, faithful and true, merry and bright, always up to the mark."
He stepped forward in a blundering, lurching movement, thrusting the cheerful young lieutenant from the Niobe aside, clapping his clenched left hand to his forehead, and holding out the other. It was not usual in the Navy for anyone much under flag rank to initiate conversation with a captain on his quarterdeck, still less to grasp his hand. But Captain Aubrey, a powerful swimmer, had had the misfortune to rescue Davis from the sea, perhaps from sharks, certainly from drowning, many years before. Davis had at no time expressed any particular gratitude, but the fact of the rescue had given him a kind of lean upon his rescuer. Having rescued him, Jack was obliged to provide for him. This seemed to be tacitly admitted by all hands, and even Jack felt that there was some obscure justice in the claim. He regretted it, however. Davis was no seaman, although he had spent his whole life afloat, a dull-witted, clumsy fellow, very strong and very dangerous when vexed or drunk, easily vexed and easily intoxicated, and he either volunteered for Jack's various ships or managed to get transferred to them, his other captains being happy to see the last of a troublesome, ignorant, untamable man.
"Well, Davis,"
said Jack, taking the hand and bracing his own to resist the bone-crushing grasp,
"I am happy to see you."
Less he could not say, the relationship being what it was, but in the faint hope of evading the gift he was telling the Niobe's lieutenant that the Worcester was so short of men that he could not possibly spare a single one in exchange, no, not even a one-legged boy, when the dryad repeated the signal, "Worcester, captain repair aboard flag."
"My barge, if you please, Mr. Pullings," said Jack,
and as he stayed to have a civil word with the Niobe's officer and to ask after Mr. Pitt, he saw Davis plunge in among the hands who were preparing to hoist the boat out, and then thrust one of its crew aside by brute force, passionately asserting his right to be one of the captain's bargemen again. Jack left Bondon and Pullings to deal with this by themselves, and stepped aft for a last draught of hot lemon. How they did so without a scene he did not know, but as he sat in the barge, wrapped in his boat cloak, with a supply of warm, dry handkerchiefs in his lap, and a ludicrous woollen comforter round his neck, he noticed that Davis was rowing number 3, pulling with his usual, very powerful, jerky, inaccurate stroke, and wearing a look of surly triumph on his ill-natured and even sinister face. Whether he was staring straight at his captain, Jack could not decide, seeing that one of Davis's eyes had a wicked cast in it. Captain Aubrey repaired aboard the flag with all possible dispatch, pulling for 3/4 of a mile through a cold and choppy sea against the wind. But the flag was not ready to receive him. The flag captain was a hospitable soul, however, and at once took him, together with the captain of the fleet, into his cabin, where he called for drinks. "Though, now I come to think of it, Aubrey," he said, examining Jack's face, his red, bottle-shaped nose with narrowed eyes, "you seem to have a cold coming on. You want to take care of these things, you know. Baker," he called to his steward, "mix a couple of glasses of my Fear Naught draught, and bring 'em hot and hot."
"I saw you swimming the other day," said the captain of the fleet, "swimming in the sea, and I said to myself, this is madness, stark staring madness. The fellow will catch cold directly and then go wandering about the squadron like a mad lunatic, spreading infection far and wide like a plague cart. Swimming, for God's sake, in a sheltered cove under proper supervision, on a warm, calm day with the sun veiled and on an empty stomach, but not too empty neither, I have nothing against it. But in the open sea, why, it is just asking for a cold. The only cure is a raw onion."
The first glass of the Fear Naught draught came in.
"Drink it while it is hot," said the flag captain.
"Oh, oh!"
cried Jack the moment it had gone down.
"God help us!"
"I learned it in Finland," said the flag captain. "Quick, the second glass or the first is mortal!"
"It is all great nonsense," said the captain of the fleet. "Nothing could be worse for you than boiling alcohol, pepper, and Spanish fly. An invalid should never touch alcohol, nor Spanish fly neither. What you want is a raw onion."
"Captain Aubrey, sir, if you please," said a deferential young man.
Admiral Hart was sitting with his secretary and a clerk. In an impressive tone he said,
"Captain Aubrey, there is a service of great importance to be performed, and it is therefore to be confided to a reliable, discreet officer."
Jack sneezed.
"If you have a cold, Aubrey," said Hart in a more natural voice, "I will thank you to sit farther off. Mr. Paul, open the scuttle. A service of great importance. You will take the Dryad under your orders and proceed to Palermo, where you will find the armed transport Polyphemus, with presents for the Pasha of Barca, and a new envoy aboard, Mr. Consul Hamilton. You will carry this gentleman and the presents to Barca with the utmost dispatch. As you are no doubt aware, the benevolent neutrality of the rulers of the Barbary States is of the first importance to us, and nothing whatsoever must be done to offend the Pasha. On the other hand, you are not to yield to any improper demands, nor sink the dignity of this country in the least degree, and you are to insist upon satisfaction in the matter of the Christian slaves. You will also carry these dispatches for our consul at Medina. They will be put aboard the Dryad when you are a day's sail from Medina. Captain Babington will stand in, deliver them to the consul, and rejoin you and the transport on your passage east. It is clear, is it not, that Dryad is to part company a full day's sail from Medina?
I believe so, sir. But in any case, I shall read my orders over and over again until I have them by road.
Like many other captains, Jack knew that in dealing with Admiral Hart, it was as well to have everything in writing. And since this was one of the few points on which a captain was entitled to run counter to a flag officer's wishes, he carried the day, though not without wrangling. Hart was badly placed, since he had an audience perfectly well acquainted with the rules of the service, and after some remarks about unnecessary delay and waste of a fair breeze, urgent service and foolish punctilio, the clerk was told to draw up a summary of Captain Aubrey's orders as quickly as he could. While it was being written out, Hart said, "Was you to be bled, it would help your cold. Even 12 or 14 ounces would do a great deal, and more would really set you up. Cure you for good and all." The notion pleased him. "Cure you for good and all," he repeated, in a low, inward voice. The Worcester and the Dryad had hardly sunk the squadron's topsails below the western horizon before the sun came out, and the breeze increased so that the sparkling blue was flecked with white horses.
"Buttons, the French call them," observed Captain Aubrey in his thick, cold-ridden voice.
"Do they indeed, sir?" said Captain Babington. "I never knew that. What a very curious notion."
"Well, you could say that they are as much like sheep as they are horses," said Jack, blowing his nose. "But sheep ain't poetical, whereas horses are."
"Are they really, sir? I was not aware."
"Of course they are, William. Nothing more poetical, except maybe doves, Pegasus, and so on. Think of the fellow in that play that calls out, 'My kingdom for a horse!' It would not have been poetry at all had he said sheep. Now, here are the orders. Read them while I finish my letter, and commit the piece that concerns you to Hart, or copy it out if you prefer."
"Well, sir," said Babington, as Jack laid down his pen, "my part seems plain sailing. I part company a day's sail from Medina, run in, deliver the dispatches to the consul there, and rejoin. Indeed, the whole trip seems pretty straightforward. Palermo, Medina, Barker, and back."
"Yes," said Jack. "So it seems to me. And at the time I wondered at the Rear Admiral, saying it was an important service, calling for a discreet officer that could be relied upon. At his saying it with such a knowing look."
There was a short silence. Jack and Babington had much the same opinion of Admiral Hart, and each knew the other's mind, but neither acknowledged this by so much as a glance.
"As pretty a run as you could wish," said Babington. "We are sure to be able to pick up some pickled tunny at Barker, let alone other stores, and then there is always the possibility of a prize, a fat merchantman from the Levant, creeping between Pantelleria and the main at dawn, and we bringing up the breeze."
"I have almost forgotten what a prize is like," said Jack.
But then the fine piratical gleam died out of his eyes, and he said,
"But those days are pretty well over, I'm afraid. Except maybe in the Adriatic or farther east. At this end, what few ships there are that a fair prize crowd sail for the African coast the moment they see one of our cruisers, and once in with the land, they are safe. These bays and pashas are so hellfire touchy about their neutrality, and their goodwill is so important to us at this stage, that the Admiral would break any man that cut out a prize on their shores, even if it were bursting with silk and pearls, gold, myrrh, and frankincense. I know that Harvey, in the Antiope, chased a very rich ship into a cove to the westward of Algiers, a cove with a paltry little tower in it, and left her there, for fear of upsetting the day. The Rear Admiral spoke about that this morning, and I see the clerk put something in the orders. Poor fellow, he was so badgered on all sides, he wrote down the essence of everything that was said. At the bottom of page 2,
scrupulous respect will be paid to the laws of neutrality.
"Whittles in 10 minutes," said Killick, coming crab-like in against the ship's strong leeward heel, carrying a tray of drinks. "Which the gents are coming aft this moment. Give the door a shove with your knee," he called out in his polished way. A muffled thump, the door flew open, Pullings and Mowat walked in, very fine in their roast-beef coats, and pleasant it was to see their frank, open delight at finding their old shipmate Babington. They had all three been midshipmen in Jack's first command. They had sailed together in some of his later ships, and although Babington, the youngest, was already a commander and likely to be made a post-captain in a year or two, while the others were only lieutenants and likely to remain in that rank for the rest of their lives, unless they had the luck to take part in a successful action, there was not the least sign of jealousy, nor of any repining at a system that, with merit roughly equal, would probably make Babington a comfortably housed admiral by the end of his career, while they lived on a half-pay of £109.10 a year. The only word that showed any awareness at all came late in the cheerful meal when Jack, having observed that if this breeze held and that if the transport did not keep them hanging about at Palermo, they should make an amazingly brisk passage, asked,
"Who has the Polyphemus now?"
No one knew. A transport agent, or even a transport commander, was a desperately obscure person, outside all hope of promotion, almost outside the service. "Some broken-winded old lieutenant, I dare say," said Pullings. And then, with a wry grin, he added, "Not but what I may be precious glad to hoist a plain blue pennant and command a transport myself one of these days." The transport did not keep them hanging about. They found her standing off and on, well north of Cape Gallo, obviously waiting for them and keeping as sharp a lookout as any man of war. They exchanged numbers, and Jack, standing on under easy sail, signalled the Polyphemus to join him. The transport dropped her topgallants, and flashed out jib and staysails in a most seamanlike manner. But since she had to beat up, tack upon tack, to fetch the Worcester's wake, he had plenty of time to observe her. This he did, quite casually at first, as he sat drinking hot lime juice in the great cabin. His telescope lay on the locker beside him, and quite early he had recognised the transport's commander, an elderly lieutenant by the name of Patterson, who had lost an arm in an unsuccessful cutting-out expedition at the beginning of the war. He was now sailing the Polyphemus, a weatherly, flush-decked ship, with great skill, keeping her as close to the wind as ever she would lie in the last long leg that would cut the Worcester's course. But it was not Patterson's steel winking in the sun, nor his exact judgment of the increasing breeze, that made Jack stare more and more, but rather something exceedingly odd that was going on amidships. It was as though the transport's people were trundling a gun up and down. But a grey gun, and a gun far larger than any first-rate would carry even on her lower tier. He could not make it out from the cabin, nor from the stern gallery, nor from the poop. On the quarter-deck he said to the signal midshipman,
"Desire the transport to pass within hail, Mr. Seymour,"
and to the officer of the watch,
"We will lie to for a moment, Mr. Collins, if you please."
The Polyphemus crossed the Worcester's wake, shot up under her lee, backed her for topsail and lay there, rising and falling on the lively sea, her commander standing with his hook fast round the aftermost main shroud, looking attentively up at the ship of the line. He was a lean, elderly man in a worn, old-fashioned uniform, and his bright yellow scratch wig contrasted oddly with his severe, humourless, sun-tanned face. But once again it was not Mr. Patterson who fixed Jack's gaze, and the gaze of every Worcester who could decently look over the side. It was the rhinoceros that stood abaft the foremast, motionless amidst its motionless attendants, the two ships being frozen into respectful silence, while their captains conversed over the water like a couple of well-conducted bulls. For propriety's sake, Jack first asked for news of the Admiral, sailed on Thursday evening, Melampus in company, for Mr. Consul Hamilton, was aboard and would wait on Captain Aubrey as soon as he could stand, was somewhat incommoded by the motion at present. And then he said,
"Mr. Patterson, what is that creature abaft the foremast?"
"It is a rhinoceros, sir, a rhinoceros of the grey species, a present for the Pasha of Barca."
"What is it doing?"
"It is exercising, sir. It must be exercised 2 hours a day to prevent its growing vicious."
Then let it carry on, Mr. Patterson. Do not stand on ceremony, I beg.
No, sir,
said Patterson, and to the seaman in charge of the party,
carry on, Clements.
As though some spring had been released, the rhinoceros and its crew started into movement. The animal took three or four twinkling little steps and lunged at Clements' vitals. Clements seized the horn and rose with it, calling out,
"Easy, easy there, old cock,"
and at the same moment the rest of the party clapped on to the fall of a travelling Burton, hoisting the rhinoceros clear of the deck. It hung by a broad belt round its middle, and for a while its legs ran nimbly on. Clements reasoned into its ear in a voice suitable to its enormous bulk, and thumped its hide in a kindly manner. And when it was lowered again, he led it forward to the foot of the foremast, holding it by the same ear and advising it
to step lively, watch for the roll, and mind where it was coming to, not to crush people with its great fat arse.
Here it was hoisted up, swung round, lowered, and led aft, walking quite meekly now, with only an occasional skip and thrust of its horn or wanton flirt of its rump. Hoisted again, turned, and led forward, to and fro under the fascinated eyes of the Worcesters, until at last it was brought to the main hatchway. Here it looked expectant, with its ears brought to bear, its dim eyes searching, its prehensile upper lip pointing from side to side. Clements gave it a ship's biscuit, which it took delicately, and ate with every appearance of appetite. But then the hatches were removed, and the creature's aspect changed. Clements blindfolded it with his black neckerchief, and by way of explanation Mr. Patterson called out,
"It is timid. It fears the darkness. Or perhaps the depth."
"Handsomely now," said Clements.
He and the rhinoceros rose a foot, travelled over the hatchway, and vanished downwards, the seaman with one hand on the rope, the other over the animal's withers, the rhinoceros with its four legs held out, stiff, its ears drooping, the image of grey anxiety.
"Lord, how I wish the doctor were here," said Jack to Pullings,
and in a louder voice,
"Mr. Patterson, I congratulate you on your management of the rhinoceros. Will you dine with me tomorrow, weather permitting?"
Mr. Patterson said that if the weather permitted, he should be happy to wait on Captain Aubrey, but he said so in a doubtful bellow, with a shake of his head to windward, where there was every appearance of wind brewing up. And in the event Jack dined alone, the three ships running east-south-east under courses and reefed topsails over a sea too rough for boats to be launched with any comfort. He was just as glad, for although the breeze was fair, and although there was a general feeling of holiday, they being away from the squadron, his cold had so increased upon him that he was scarcely fit for company. Again he said to Pullings at breakfast,
"I wish the doctor were here."
He felt that it would be disloyal to Stephen to summon Mr. Lewis, and before dinner he tried some of the remedies that had been suggested. They, or the wine he drank, may have done some good, for as they approached the Pantelleria Channel and he spread his forces in the faint hope of a prize, he found his spirits rise to a fine point of cheerfulness. The hope was faint indeed, yet it had a reasonable existence. There were still some ships that would risk the eastern run for the sake of the enormous profits, and although these were fast, knowing craft upon the whole, often in the privateering or the smuggling line, this was one of the few sea lanes in which they were less rare than elsewhere, and in this stretch of sea with this southwest wind a blockade runner, beating up for home, would be at a great disadvantage. He was so hoarse that Pullings was obliged to relay his orders, but it was with real satisfaction that he saw the Dryad steer south and the Polyphemus north until they were spread out so that in line abreast the three of them could survey the great part of the channel. A sparkling day, warm in spite of the wind, a truly Mediterranean day at last, with splendid visibility, white clouds racing across a perfect sky, their shadows showing purple on a sea royal blue where it was not white. An absurd day to have a cold on.
"Should you not go below for a while, sir?" said Pullings to him privately. "It is perhaps a little damp."
"Nonsense," said Jack. "If everybody started taking notice of a cold, good heavens, where would one be? The war might come to an end. In any case, we can only sweep for a little while. We lose Dryad once we are a day's sail from Medina, say at the height of Cape Carmo."
All day long they sailed, searching the sea from their mastheads, and nothing did they find apart from a group of tunny boats out of Lampedusa, who sold them some fish and told them that a French Smyrna man, the Aurore, had passed the day before, deeply laden and somewhat crippled, having been mauled by a Greek pirate from Tenedos. They took it philosophically, as sailors must if they are not to run mad, being so subject to wind and tide and current, and with the sun going down astern while the full moon rose ahead, the Worcester sent the Dryad away for Medina, called the Polyphemus in, and stood eastward with her, the breeze abating with the close of day. An easy sail and a flowing sheet, and while Jack consoled himself with gluck and toasted cheese, the hands gathered on the forecastle and danced in the warm moonlight until the setting of the watch, and, by Pulling's leave, beyond it. They were heartier still since Jack had his skylight open and the wind had hauled forward, but it was a cheerful sound, one that he loved to hear as signifying a happy ship. The confused distant noise, the familiar tunes, the laughter, the clap of hands and the rhythmic jump of feet was full of memories for him too, and as he wandered up and down his spacious, lonely domain, cocking his ear to the sound of Ho the Dandy Kiddy-O, he cut a few heavy, lumbering steps in spite of his cold. When he lay in his cot, swinging to the Worcester's lift and roll, his mind drifted back to the days when he too had belonged on the forecastle, when he too had danced to the fiddle and fife, his upper half grave and still, his lower flying, heel and toe, the double harmon, the cut and come again, the Kentish knock, the bobs a dying and its variations in quick succession and, if the weather was reasonably calm, in perfect time. To be sure there was a golden haze over those times, and some of the gold was no doubt false, mere pinchbeck at the best. But even so they had an irreplaceable quality of their own, perfect, unthinking health, good company upon the whole, no responsibility apart from the immediate task in hand. And he was thinking of the rare, noisy, strenuous, good-natured fun they had had when hands were piped to mischief as he fell asleep, smiling still. His sleeping mind often strayed far away, sometimes home to his wife and garden, sometimes to beds less sanctified, but now it scarcely stirred from the ship, and he woke with the word Thursday in his ears, as clearly as if it had been shouted. Of course it was Thursday. Hammocks had been piped up early, well before sunrise, at the end of the middle watch, and his unconscious being had no doubt recorded the fact. Long, long ago he too would have been required to rise and shine, to show a leg and rouse out there in the dark, cold or no cold. Now he could take his ease. On Thursdays, the Worcester presented her less glorious, less martial, more domestic face. Unless the weather was extraordinarily foul, or unless the ship was in action, she washed her clothes that morning in enormous tubs and rigged clotheslines fore and aft, while in the afternoon all hands were piped to make and mend. It was also the day when Jack was invited to dine in the wardroom, and as he went there at the appointed hour by way of the quarter-deck and the companion ladder, he surveyed as fine a show of washing as the heart could desire. 1,000 shirts and more, 500 pair of duck trousers, countless handkerchiefs and smalls, all waving and fluttering in the breeze. It was true that they were all washed in sea-water, the Worcester being short of fresh, that since the soap would not lather they were not very clean, and that they were harsh and salty to the touch. But they made a brave, many-coloured show, a cheering sight. In the wardroom itself his presence had less of a damping effect than usual. There were few officers who had not either a cure for a cold or an account of a very shocking, long-lasting bout, caught on some particular and clearly defined occasion, such as the leaving off of a waistcoat, the wearing of a Magellan jacket on watch one night and not on the next, standing talking to a woman with one's hat off, rain falling on one's hair, sitting in a draught, an untimely sweat. And these topics carried the meal on to the more informal stage of general conversation. Jack said little. He could not, being almost voiceless, but he looked, and indeed felt, amiable, and being adjured on all hands, to feed a cold, sir, and starve a fever, he ate a great deal of the fresh tunny that graced half the table's length, so welcome a change from salt pork. At the same time he listened to the talk at his end of the table. Rhinoceroses, how best stowed, their probable weight, their diet,
the one-horned kind and the two were found. Anecdote of a Sumatra rhinoceros belonging to HMS Ariel, its appetite for grog and unhappy end. The properties of powdered rhinoceros horn taken inwardly. Regret at Dr. Maturin's absence. A health to the absent doctor. Barker and the possibility of renewing their livestock, at least in sheep and poultry. The likelihood of the Pashas coming at the Handsome in the article of bullocks, in view of the rhinoceros and a cargo of no doubt equally valuable presents. At the far end, however, Mowat and Rowan, the man who had replaced the lovely Summers, seemed to be in disagreement, strong and even acrimonious disagreement. Rowan was a round-faced, bright-eyed young fellow with a rather decided air. Jack had seen enough of him to know that although he was a man of little formal education, a West Country shipwright's son, he was a competent officer and a great improvement on Summers. But apart from that, he had gathered little, and now, during a momentary pause in the talk on either side of him, he was surprised to hear Rowan say, "I may not know what a dactyl is, but I do know that, will you take, a piece of cake is poetry, whatever you may say. It rhymes, don't it? And if what rhymes ain't poetry, what is?" Jack quite agreed, and he was morally certain that Mowat did not know what a dactyl was either, though he loved him dearly. "I'll tell you what poetry is," cried Mowat. "Poetry is—" The midshipman of the watch came darting in. "Big pardon, sir," he said at Jack's elbow. "Mr. Whiting's duty, and Dryad is in sight from the masthead, sir, 2 points on the starboard bow." "At least we think it is Dryad," he added, quite ruining the effect. It would be strange if there could have been a mistake about the Dryad, with her man-of-war's pennant and her distinctive rig. But it would also be strange, the breeze being what it was, if the Dryad could possibly have reached such a position without carrying an extraordinary press of sail.
"What is she wearing?"
"Skyscrapers, sir." That was decisive. No man-of-war would be flying out from the land, cracking on to that perilous degree, unless she were the Dryad.
"Very well, Mr. Seymour," he said. "My compliments to Mr. Whiting, and he may make sail to close the Dryad, if Dryad she be. I shall come on deck after dinner."
And in an aside to Puddings, he added,
"It would be a pity to waste a crumb of this glorious treacle crowdy."
Dryad she was, coming along as fast as ever her ungainly form would allow her. With a fine breeze on the beam and every sail that she could possibly bear, she made very nearly 9 knots, trembling as she did so, and from the utmost limit of signalling distance, flying a request to speak to the Worcester. For her part, the Worcester, on the opposite tack, ran 10 knots clean off the reel once she had stowed her remaining laundry away, and the two therefore approached one another over that empty, brilliant sea so fast that they were within hailing distance before the inhabitants of the wardroom had been on deck, digesting their dinner for more than half an hour. This was the first time, apart from practice, that the Worcester had spread her royals and loftier staysails since she came into the Mediterranean, the first time that her present complement had ever done so in more than a capful of wind. And although the fine, urgent leeward lean of the ship, the strong rush of water along her side, and the white bow wave spreading wide lifted Jack's heart, he looked very thoughtful indeed as he watched some of the orders being carried out. Many of the midshipmen and some of the upper yardsmen did not understand their duty, and the setting of the mizzen-to-gallant staysail would have cost one youngster a terrible fall, if not his life, but for the captain of the top, who caught him by the hair. And then, when the ship was to fold her wings, as it were, her multiplicity of wings, to lie to for Babington to come aboard, he saw some very odd sights, such as 2 leading members of the Hallelujah Chorus heaving upon a rope with immense zeal and goodwill in the wrong direction, until a distracted boatswain's mate beat them off. Better judges of handle than the finer points of seamanship. There were not enough real seamen aboard, that was the trouble. These inland fellows, if properly shoved into place, could go through the ordinary motions well enough by now, or at least without disgrace, but in anything like an emergency, many of them would be all to seek, quite lost without direction. The ship brought by the lee at night, for example, or laid on her beam ends in a squall, or closely engaged with a determined enemy, spars, blocks, and even masts falling about her ears. A crew of able seamen, or even of ordinary seamen, was not formed in a few months, and the only way of growing used to storm and battle was to work through both.
He wondered how some of his people would behave on their first introduction to either, for he did not count what few blows they had had so far, or the trifle of gunfire, as emergencies, still less as storm or battle. These thoughts were prompted in part by the excellent seamanship displayed by the Dryad, and they were now dispelled by the sight of her captain coming aboard the Worcester as though there were not a moment to be lost. And to judge by his shining face as he came up the side, it was good news that he was bringing.
"The French are in Medina, sir,"
he said the moment they were in the cabin.
"Are they, by God?"
cried Jack, stopping short.
"Yes, sir, a 74 and a 36-gun frigate."
He had come upon them suddenly as he turned the dogleg into the Goletta, the long channel leading up to the port of Medina. There they lay, moored under the larger of the two batteries guarding the entrance to the Goletta, and if he had not instantly hauled his wind, the Dryad must have been carried past them into the channel, her escape cut off.
"Did they fire?" asked Jack.
"No, sir. I fancy they were as taken aback as I was, and I did not leave them much time to recover their surprise. I clawed off as quick as ever I could. Dryad came about beautifully, though we had only one reef out of our topsails. We weathered the cape with 10 yards to spare and then cracked on regardless to join you, so that we could go back and destroy them together."
Babington seemed to entertain no sort of doubt about the destruction of the French ships, none about the propriety of his conduct. Presumably his dispatches would be delivered to the consul in Medina once the destruction had taken place.
"Lord, sir," he said, "how I hope they're still there."
"Well, William,"
said Jack,
"we shall soon find out."
For his own part, he hoped they had put to sea. Quite apart from the whole thorny question of neutrality, any action against moored ships was not unlike a soldier's battle. The unpredictable sea changes were not there. Superior seamanship could not seize upon a shifting slant of wind, the tail of a current or a shoal, and turn it into a decisive advantage, but would have to fight a motionless opponent, one unaffected by the breeze or lack of it, with all his hands free to fire the great guns or repel boarders. At sea there was room for manoeuvre, room for luck, and he was a great believer in luck. If the Frenchmen had put to sea, as he hoped, their course would almost certainly be for the Straits. Yet with this breeze they could not yet have worked to the windward of Cape Hamada, and there was every likelihood that by steering west-southwest he would find them under his lee in the morning. He would have the weather gauge, and with it the initiative, the power of choosing the moment and the closeness of action. All sorts of possibilities would be open to him, and to make the odds more nearly even he would need every happy turn that offered. For although the Worcester could probably deal with an average French 74 by a short battering and then by boarding her, the Dryad and the Polyphemus could not possibly undertake a well-handled frigate except by clever manoeuvring, so that at least one raked her while the Worcester brought her other broadside to bear. It could be done. The engagement, though unequal, could be brought to a successful end, given luck and less skilful opponents. Luck had nearly always been with him in battle, or at least rarely against him, but there was no guarantee that these Frenchmen would be less skilful or that they would let themselves be outmanoeuvred and destroyed piecemeal. There were inept French sailors, to be sure, but not nearly so many as people in London seemed to believe, and as far as he was concerned, the French sea officers he had come into contact with had usually been thoroughly able, wily, and courageous. As the three ships ran west-southwest under all the sail the slowest could bear, he sat snorting and gasping over his charts, drinking lemon shrub hot, and reflecting upon some of the French commanders he had known. The formidable Lenoir, who had taken him in the Mediterranean, and who had very nearly sunk him in the Indian Ocean. Lucas, who had fought the Redoutable so brilliantly at Trafalgar. Christy Palliere. Many others. On the other hand, these ships had almost certainly escaped from Toulon in one of the recent blows, and although their officers might be capable enough, it was unlikely that their crews would have much experience. Yet were his own people much better? If he did meet the French at sea, and if things went as he hoped they would, with the Worcester between the 74 and the frigate, he would obviously have to fire both broadsides at the same time. That would be the whole point of the manoeuvre. But so far the Worcesters had had almost no training at all in that unusual operation.
"That can be remedied, however, at least to some small extent,"
he said aloud in a hoarse croak,
and for the rest of the day laundry, ironing, making and mending were all laid aside, while the people went through the motions of fighting both sides of the ship at once, the gun crews running from starboard to larboard as fast as ever they could, sweating in the afternoon sun, heaving guns in and out in tearing high spirits from beginning to end. Labour lost, however, for the Polyphemus spoke to an Algerine galley, an old and trustworthy acquaintance, and learnt that the Frenchmen had not sailed from Medina, had no intention of sailing, but had warped closer to the Goletta Mole. Mr. Patterson brought this information himself, and Jack observed that his eyes were as bright as his steel hook, his whole ungainly person filled with fresh youth. There was the same elation on the Worcester's quarter-deck, throughout the ship indeed, and Jack wondered at his own lack of joy. This was the first time that the prospect of action had not moved him like the sound of a trumpet. It was not that he dreaded the outcome, although this engagement was of that uncomfortable sort called a point-of-honour fight, an action where one's force was just too great to allow a decent, unblameable retreat, yet not great enough to give much reasonable hope of success, but rather that he did not look forward to it with his usual eagerness. His heart did beat higher, but not very much higher, his mind being too much oppressed by material worries to do with the ship, with the conduct of a battle of this kind, and with the probable attitude of the Bay of Medina to be able to take much active pleasure in the prospect.
"It will be all right once the dust starts to fly," he said to himself,
and he gave the order that would carry the three ships to Medina as fast as the stiff breeze would carry them. Dawn showed Cape Malbec fine on the starboard bow, and by the time the decks were washed and flogged dry, the ships had opened the deep bay with Medina far away at the bottom of it. The wind slackened with the rising sun, but it was still as fair as could be wished, and they stood in towards the distant town, keeping close to the western shore, gliding by the long line of salt lagoons so close that they could see the files of camels with their shining loads. At one point an undulating cloud of flamingos wafted over the sea, showing scarlet as they all wheeled together, 10 or 20,000 strong.
"How I wish the doctor were here,"
said Jack once more, but Pullings only returned a formal, "Yes, sir," and Jack was strongly aware of the many eyes turned upon him from the crowded quarter-deck, and, somewhat more furtively, from the poop, the gangways, the main-top, and points forward. The last patches of deck were clean and dry. The last falls had been coiled down. There was no immediate task in hand, and the ship was extraordinarily silent. Hardly a sound, but the even song of the breeze in the rigging, and the hiss of the smooth water running down the Worcester's side. He knew that the hands were longing to clear her for action. The moral pressure was as perceptible as the warmth of the sun, and after a moment's listening to a sudden outburst of goose-like gabbling from the flamingos, he said,
"Mr. Pullings, let the hands be piped to breakfast. When they have finished, we may go to quarters, and we shall be well advised to take advantage of the galley fires ourselves before they are—"
He would have added, "put out," if a fit of sneezing had not prevented him. But the missing words were clearly understood, and in any case the boatswain's mates had already started their calls. Usually Jack asked Pullings and a midshipman or two to breakfast with him, but today, after a sleepless night, most of it on deck, he really felt too jaded for even Pullings' conversation, and he retired alone, blowing his reddened nose as he went and murmuring,
"Oh dear, oh dear, God damn and blasted,"
into his handkerchief. It was his rule always to eat hearty before an action or the probability of an action, and Killick set a dish of bacon on the table with 4 fried eggs, saying apologetically that
"that was all there was so far this morning, but the speckled hen might lay any minute now."
He ate them mechanically, but neither they nor even his coffee had their natural savour, and when Killick came triumphantly in with a 5th egg, he could not look at it with any pleasure. He tossed it, privately, out of the quarter-gallery scuttle, and as he followed its flight he saw the sea turn brown, then clear again. In their eagerness to be clearing the ship and casting loose their guns, the hands had started their tubs of cocoa over the side.
"Chips,"
said Killick, jerking his thumb over his shoulder, and a moment later the carpenter came in, followed by some of his crew and the captain's joiner. Rather more civilly than the steward, he asked if he might begin.
"Just let me down this cup, Mr. Watson," said Jack, drinking the last of his ill-tasting coffee, "and the place is yours. You will take particular care of the doctor's object, will you not?"
he added, pointing at Stephen's dressing case, now doing duty as a music stand.
"Never you fret, sir," said the carpenter, pointing at the joiner in much the same manner. "Pond here has made a special case for it, lined with junk."
"It is not an article that should ever have gone to sea," said the aged joiner, in a discontented voice, "still less into action."
As Jack left the cabin, he heard them attack the bulkheads, knocking out the wedges with a splendid zeal, and rolling up the checkered canvas deckcloth. Before he had taken half a dozen turns on the quarterdeck, Stephen's object and all the cabin furniture, crockery and glass, had been struck down into the hold, the bulkheads had vanished, and with them his various apartments, so that there was a clean sweep fore and aft, and the impatient gun crews could get at their charges, the pair of 32-pounder carronades that Jack had installed in the coach. They were too early. Far too early. There were still miles of Salt Lake to pass. The harbour at the far end of the bay was still dim and misty in the shadow of the hills behind the town, and Jack had not the least notion of sailing into the enclosed water without surveying the whole of it. He ordered the courses to be hauled up in the brails, and now the Worcester and her consorts moved more slowly, under the usual fighting trim of topsails alone. There were a fair number of country craft moving in and out in the morning light, tunny boats and coral fishers, and two Corsair Zeebecks with immense black lateen sails passed the Worcester on the opposite tack, low to the water, moving very fast. They were crammed with men, and as they swept by, scores of faces looked up, brown, shining black, sunburnt white, some bearded, some smooth, most turbaned or skull-capped, all keen and predatory. Jack glanced at them with strong dislike and looked away.
"Let us make a tour of the ship," he said to Pullings.
As he had expected with such a first lieutenant, everything was in order. Hatches laid, the decks so carefully dried not long ago now wetted and sanded, scuttlebutts of fresh water amidships for the men to drink, shot garlands full, arms chests open. The guns were not run out yet, since the ship had not beat to quarters, but the slow match for firing them was smouldering away in its little tubs, sending its fierce, well-remembered scent along the decks, and the boarders already had their cutlasses, or those axes with a spike that some preferred in a hand-to-hand engagement. There were hands, both seamen and landsmen, who looked anxious, and some were overexcited, but most were gravely cheerful, quiet, and self-contained. It was a time of unusual freedom, and those who had sailed into action with Jack before talked to him as he went round.
"Remember Surprise, Your Honour, and the dinner they gave us in Calcutta?"
"The breeze lay just so when we took the big Spaniard."
And Joseph Place said something so witty about the Sophie that his own mirth made the end incomprehensible. Not that Jack had thoroughly understood even the beginning, since the cold had interfered with his hearing. It did not affect his sight, however, and when, having finished his tour, he climbed into the maintop with a telescope, he saw Medina plain. The sun shone on the golden mosque, its dome and minaret, and on the inner harbour, too shallow for vessels of any draught, but the fortopsail cut off his view of the Goletta.
"Larboard a point!" he called,
and as the ship turned, so the long canal came into sight, with some merchantmen unloading at its wharves and a good many small craft. At its seaward end, two towers, one either side of the entrance, marking the end of the two long moles, or breakwaters, that closed the bottom of the bay. Two curving lines of masonry on the colossal Phoenician and Roman scale that linked reefs and steep two islands for a mile on either hand. And now, as the Worcester steadied, he saw the Frenchmen perfectly, a ship of the line and a frigate. They had moved since the Dryad's visit, and now they were moored a cable's length from the farther tower, where the mole curved inward between two small islands, moored so close in that there was no passing between them and the stonework. The French commander was obviously determined that there should be no repetition of the Nile. He had made sure that no enemy could double upon him, taking him between two fires, and he had also taken up such a position in his little bay that it would be impossible to lie athwart his hawse and rake him,
since his bows were protected by the solid masonry. The frigate also lay snugly in this recess, and in her case the outward curve shielded her stern. Both ships were moored with their starboard broadsides to the sea, and between them there was a gap of some 40 yards. The French boats were very busy in this gap, and for a while Jack could not make out what they were at. He leant on the barricade of tight-packed hammocks and focused more exactly. Landing guns on the mole. That was what they were at, the dogs. Guns from their larboard broadsides to make a battery commanding the interval between the ships. Guns and casks, spars and hammocks to protect them. Even if they shifted only the lighter, more get-at-able guns, they would soon have the equivalent of the second frigate's broadside, judging by their present energy. And since their ships were moored, they would have all the hands they needed to fight them, and as many again, an enormous increase in their firepower.
"Let fall the forecastle,"
he cried, and slinging his telescope he ran down on deck.
"Hoist out the launch and the cutters,"
he said, and to the signal midshipman,
"Dryad and Polyphemus, captains repair aboard."
The Worcesters were still making heavy weather of the ponderous launch when Babington and Patterson came running up the side.
"You see the position, gentlemen," said Jack. "They are landing their guns as fast as they can. Six are already in position. In an hour's time the place will be another goddamned Gibraltar impossible to be attempted. I intend to engage the 74 yardarm to yardarm for 5 minutes, and then to board her in the smoke. I desire you will cram your ships under my stern, and second me at the given word, boarding her over the bows or by way of our stern if you cannot get there. While we are engaged, play upon her head and forecastle with your small arms. I doubt any of your great guns will bear. But listen, gentlemen, listen. Not a musket, not a pistol, let alone a great gun, must be fired until they have fired on us, and I give the word loud and clear. Spread all your officers and midshipmen among the hands with the strictest possible orders to that effect. Tell them that any man who fires before the word shall have 500 lashes, and by God's name I mean 500 lashes, and the officer whose division he belongs to shall be broke. That is clearly understood?"
"Yes, sir," said Babington.
Patterson smiled his rare smile and said he understood perfectly, but they need not worry. He had never known a Frenchman respect a port's neutrality in all his life, not if the odds were on his side.
"I hope you're right, Mr. Patterson," said Jack, "but whether or no, those are my absolute orders. Now let us go about our business before the odds grow greater still."
They shook hands, and he saw them to the side. Then, turning to Pullings, he said,
"Beat to quarters,"
and loud over the instant thunder of the drum,
"Pass the word for Captain Harris."
The marine came running from his station on the poop.
"Captain Harris," said Jack, "it is my intention to board the 74 after a very short cannonade. In the meantime, you will take a party round the enemy's stern in the boats, drive them from their battery on the mole, and turn the guns against the frigate. Have you any comments?"
"None, sir. Only that it would be an uncommon pretty stroke."
"Then take as many of your men from the guns as you think fit. We can manage short-handed for a short burst. Let them be in the boats and out of sight when we are alongside the Frenchman, ready to pull round the moment I give the signal."
Word with the gunner. Appropriate guns to be drawn and reloaded with chain shot or bar for the first round, to destroy the enemy's boarding netting. With the boatswain, grapnels to make the Frenchman fast, prime hands in the tops to run out and lash his yardarms. With the master, on the course to steer, luffing up the second they were past the island that made the near corner of the bay. With Pullings, about leadsmen in the channels, so that they might keep as close inshore as possible, about the replacement of the marines. A dozen other points. He was deeply pleased by the amount of intelligent anticipation he found. Most of the things he called for were already on their way, most of the measures already in hand. He savoured this for a moment, watching the mole come nearer. Its towers were 1,000 yards away, and the Frenchmen something farther, and waiting for the din of the top-chains being put to the yards to stop. There were many other things he would have liked to order, but with the Frenchmen landing their guns at this rate, he must engage at once, and in any case the essential had been done. The yards were chained. The clashing stopped.
"Worcesters,"
said Jack in as strong a croak as he could manage,
"I am going to lay the ship alongside that French 74. "We do not fire a shot until I give the word. She must fire first. That's the law. Then, when I give the word, we thump in four brisk broadsides and board her in the smoke. Those that have not boarded before will not go far wrong if they knock the nearest Frenchman on the head. But remember this. Any man that fires before I give the word gets 500 lashes.
As an inspiriting harangue, this did not perhaps rank very high. But Captain Aubrey was no orator, and he had rarely done much better. In any case, it seemed to satisfy the Worcester's people, and he left the deck to a murmured sound of approval.
4 rounds brisk, then board.
He stepped below to the half-deck, where Killick was waiting with his second-best uniform coat and his fighting sword, a heavy cavalry sabre. Many seamen clubbed their pigtails in time of action, but Killick rolled his up into a tight ball. This, combined with a pursed look of disapproval, gave him more the air of an ill-looking shrew than ever. He hated seeing good clothes put at risk, and as he helped Jack on with the coat, he muttered something about
"taking care of them epaulets. Cost the bleeding eyes out of your head."
For his own part, he had changed the duck trousers and blue jacket that he wore as captain's steward for a very squalid old shirt and petticoat breeches, which heightened the resemblance. Buckling on Jack's sword, he said,
"There is a fresh supply of wipes in both the pockets, which you could do with one now."
"Thank ye, Killick,"
said Jack, blowing his nose. He had forgotten his cold until that moment, and he forgot it again when he returned to the quarter-deck. The enemy were now less than half a mile away, partly concealed by the island and the outward curve of the mole. The Worcester, under topsails, was making 5 knots. The launch and the cutters, full of marines, were towing easily along on the larboard side, out of sight of the French. The Dryad and the Polyphemus lay exactly in their stations. No sound but the leadsman.
"By the deep, 11. By the deep, 11. By the mark, 10.
In about 3 minutes they would pass the mouth of the Goletta, squaring main and mizzen yards to reduce speed. And about 2 minutes after that the dust would begin to fly. It was a fairly hazardous stroke, and much would depend on the Frenchmen's estimate of the Polyphemus. She was a large transport capable of carrying the best part of a regiment, and if they thought she was full of soldiers, they would be less likely to withstand the first decisive shock with full, aggressive confidence. But hazardous or not, it was the only attack he could launch at this short notice. In any event, the die was cast, and fate must look after the event. At present his chief anxiety was that no zealous, excited hand should touch off the first shot and put the Worcester legally in the wrong. He knew the importance of the Barbary state's benevolent neutrality. He clearly remembered the words in his orders, "Scrupulous respect will be paid to the laws of neutrality," and he looked keenly along the deck. There was a midshipman to every 2 guns. He had stripped his quarter-deck, and an officer to every 7, and all the gun captains were experienced man-of-war's men. Nothing could be safer. He dismissed that anxiety. Another instantly took its place. The ship was fast approaching the entrance to the Goletta. Its 2 towers were fine on her starboard bow, and now, at this moment, from between them came a swarm of shrimp boats, rushing out in some kind of a ceremony, to the sound of innumerable conches. Presumably they expected the Worcester to turn right-handed into the channel, but whether or no, they stood on, all sails set, right across her path, and Jack had only just time to back the foretopsail to avoid running down the nearest. His hoarse, almost voiceless croak was not adequate to the occasion, and he said to little Calamy, his only remaining aide-de-camp midshipman,
"Come forward! Tell Mr. Holler to hail him to bear up! We are standing on!"
From his station on the forecastle the boatswain hailed them with enormous force, in what lingua franca he possessed, helped out by passionate gestures. They seemed to understand him, and turning to starboard, they sailed along in a disorderly, straggling heap, roughly in the same direction as the Worcester, but slanting diagonally across her course, to gain the open sea while she proceeded along the mole. The Worcester filled her foretopsail and surged on. Now the Goletta was astern, with the Frenchmen's inlet sweeping close, and Jack's whole being was poised for the order that would carry the ship round the island and bring her grinding alongside the enemy. He and every seaman in the ship were so poised when part of the shrimping fleet suddenly steered inshore. For no conceivable reason they steered inshore, and ran slowly past the island and along the mole. The island was at hand. The mainyard almost brushed it. The master said, "Port your helm!" And here was the inlet, with a score of brown lateen-sailed shrimpers, and beyond them the French ship of the line, colours flying, all gun ports open wide. There was not the least possibility of grappling her without crushing the shrimpers.
"Shall I squeeze him, sir?"
asked the master from behind the wheel.
"No," said Jack. "Haul your wind!"
In these few seconds, an irretrievable space had passed by. The Worcester was already astern of the 74, and with this breeze no seamanship on earth could bring her back.
"Make sail!"
said Jack, and followed by the Dryad and the Polyphemus, the ship stood on, braced for the fire of the shore battery and the frigate, now abreast. It did not come, and gathering speed they passed the second island, out of the French gun's reach. The extreme tension relaxed. There had been no wild shot from the Worcester nor from her consorts, but none from the Frenchmen either. It was true that the country craft had partly masked the battery and the frigate, as well as the ship of the line, but even so Jack had seen the small arms men in their tops, he had seen their muskets trained on him, the gleam of the barrels as they followed his movements. Yet not a shot had they fired. Although there could no longer be any element of surprise, and although the Polyphemus's inoffensive character was now evident, and although the landing party of marines had been clearly seen, the three ships tacked once they had made a decent offing. The breeze, which had been so kind, was growing fainter and veering south of east, so that a repetition of their course would be difficult indeed. Not that there could be any exact repetition, reflected Jack, as he watched the Frenchmen through his telescope. He saw intense activity over there, in striking contrast to what he remembered as their total immobility during their few moments of near contact. His memory might be mistaken. It often was in moments of extremely vivid life, and there might have been some movement apart from that wicked creep of musket barrels, the part of close action that he liked the least, when officers were picked off like sitting birds. But at all events they were very busy now, warping the 74 so close to the island that her bowsprit overhung the rock, and it would no longer be possible for the Dryad and the Polyphemus to board her over the bows. They were also hurrying still more guns ashore. Not that the Worcester was idle, with her marines coming aboard again and her seamen getting a cable out of the aftermost larboard port so that she could anchor bow and stern and perhaps come to grips again. There was also the straightforward manoeuvring to bring the ship back to somewhere near her point of departure.
"Sir," said Harris, "may I suggest landing my men on the landward side of the mole and approaching the battery from behind? It would be strange if the Frenchmen did not let fly, seeing us coming for them at the double with fixed bayonets."
Jack did not answer for a moment. He stared at the crowds now hurrying along the mole to see the fun, and in his mind's eye he saw the Worcester's marines among them moving in neat platoons. Could such a spectacle conceivably be reconciled with neutrality? He did not know Harris, and although the man certainly had courage, he also had a deeply stupid face. Could he be trusted not to fire first, or indeed not to charge anything in sight, including perhaps the Bay's troops if they were to intervene? Then again, any unforeseen delay on either side, anything but perfect synchronization, might expose the marines to the fire of both ships' remaining larboard guns. It was a spirited suggestion, but without luck, intelligent dash, and exact timing, it must lead to endless complications.
"A capital suggestion, Captain Harris," he said, "but this time I mean to shoot beyond her, dropping a stern anchor to swing alongside with the breeze. There will be no room in the ship for the boarding."
"Haul off all,"
cried Pullings, and the mole with its Frenchmen vanished behind the foresail as the Worcester began her second run. More slowly now, as close-hauled as she could be, with the old quartermasters at the wheel staring up at the weather leeches of the sails, always on the edge of shivering. Jack blew his nose at some length and walked across to the starboard side. The Goletta mouthed again, and as the ship passed the farther tower, a man in a splendid turban made gestures towards him with a horse-tail banner. What the gestures meant he could not tell, nor could he put his mind to it, for here was the outward curve, the island, the corner they must turn to fall upon the enemy. And here was a party of Frenchmen, dragging a heavy carronade to command the line of approach. A moment later, and they could have raked him with a hail of grape.
"Steady fore and aft," he said.
Then,
"Stand by, the axes! Stand by!"
"Hard over," murmured the master in the silence.
"Hard over it is, sir," said the helmsman,
and the Worcester came round into the Frenchmen's bay. She hung there, her backed main topsail exactly balancing the other's thrust, poised for the first gun, and for the order that would carry her forward to cut away her anchors and so swing against the enemy's side there in his sheltered nook. The first gun never came, nor yet the order. This same impression of stillness and silence. The French ship's side was higher than the Worcester's, and even by standing on a gun Jack could not see over the hammocks to her quarter-deck, which gave the strangest feeling of impersonality. All her ports were open, all her guns run out. Her barricaded waist was lined with soldiers, their hats and muskets showing. Thin wafts of smoke drifted from the lower ports. Otherwise there was no movement at all, except in the tops, where the same musket barrels pointed at him, gently varying their angle with the heave of the sea. After a few seconds, it was clear to Jack that the French commander's orders about firing first were as rigid and as strictly obeyed as his own. The minutes dropped by. With great skill, the master kept the Worcester in equilibrium until an odd gust drove her a trifle out, and she began forging very slowly ahead. The men stationed by the hanging anchors raised their axes, waiting for the word. But Jack shook his head.
"Fill the main yard," he said in his hoarse voice.
The Worcester surged forward, moving across the face of the battery, now much stronger, but as quiet and unmoving as the 74, and past the equally silent frigate. Here at least he could look down into her, and on her quarter-deck he saw her captain, a short, capable, grave-looking man, standing there with his hands behind his back, looking up. Their eyes met, and at the same moment each moved his hat to the other. Jack was perfectly convinced that the Frenchman in command was determined not to fire the first shot, but since there might be some fool among the 1,000 men moored against the mole, he led his ships up and down again. Fools there may well have been, but none in charge of a gun, or even a musket, and the French were not to be provoked.
"May we not try just once more, sir, giving them a cheer as we go down?" asked Pullings in his ear.
"No, Tom, it will not do," said he. "If we stay here another half hour, with the breeze veering like this, we shall never get out of this goddamned bay, wind-bound for weeks, mewed up with these miserable brutes."
Turning from Pulling's bitter distress, he raised his voice, addressing the master.
"Mr. Gill, pray lay her for Cape Miro, and then let us shape a course for Barca."
He took a few turns up and down the quarter-deck in order not to evade the disappointed looks of the crews housing their guns, the sullen, disappointed atmosphere, the flat sense of anticlimax. The ship was profoundly dissatisfied with him. He was profoundly dissatisfied with himself.